This episode is brought to you by Naoki Takahashi, a Japanese restaurant in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, we're celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we are just getting started. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, gang, just a quick promotional note. I am going back out on the road this spring and summer. Come say hello. I'll be at the Philly Chefs Conference, at Drexel University in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in March, at the Chef's Roll Anti-Convention in San Diego in April, and at the Culinary Vegetable Institute at the Chef's Garden in Milan, Ohio, for a Chefs of the 80s dinner in June. Information and links to tickets at tokeland.com/appearances.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I was already starting to realize my own like confidence in decision making for myself, and that, you know, that doesn't, I don't know where that came from. I feel like I had a lot of courageousness in my family that they recognized and would tell me. All my siblings would say how courageous I am because I was fearless in doing things like on family vacations, jumping into like using a rope swing and jumping into a pool of water or like a lake, and none of them wanted to do it. I don't know where that came from. So that felt really intrinsic, this like courageousness or courage.
That is Chef Angela DiMayuga, Creative Director of Food and Culture for Standard International, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and I'm here for the first time this year, for longtime listeners, with Caitlin Friedman. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning, Andrew. I feel like we haven't done this in forever.
We haven't done it in forever. You made a little cameo at our live show.
Yes, that was scary, but definitely fun.
You didn't sound scared.
I know.
Everyone tells me how much more natural you are than I am.
It's true. Doesn't have my name on
it. You should have the show.
No.
You should have the show.
No.
All right, listen, I have a longish interview today that I want to get right to. Angela DiMayuga has this amazing job. She is the Creative Director of Food and Culture for Standard International, best known for the Standard Hotels. Isn't that a cool-sounding job?
Yeah, that's kind of an awesome job. Does she love it?
She seems very happy. She's about a year in. She got known to the food world as the chef of Mission Chinese here in New York City, where she spent several years, made a huge impact there, left, and about a year ago joined the Standard. They created that position for her. And Angela became very well known, not just for her food while she was at Mission, but I was going to say outspoken. That sounds awfully one-dimensional. She incorporates all kinds of elements of culture into what she does. So she did a lot of partnerships, and not just at the restaurant, but also on the road with artists, party throwers, event creators. I don't know the proper language. I'm not cool enough to know all the terminology, but just involved in all kinds of things. She's very outspoken about her political views. She's very devoted to the cause of inclusion and representation. She personally is of Filipino descent. Her parents were Filipino immigrants to the United States. She is our first guest who self-identifies as queer, which we talked about briefly toward the end of the interview. At the same time, she's also sort of known for her attire, her look, her fashion. She's pretty glam. Despite all of that, she's the most accessible, down-to-earth, fun, charming person to talk to, and I think people are going to absolutely love this interview.
You were really looking forward to this interview. I remember you mentioned it last week. You called me as soon as it was over, and you were like, she's pretty fantastic. So
she's pretty great. Yeah. Also, I mean, look how much I prepped. Look at the stack of – have you ever seen me prep this much for an interview?
Yeah, you prep. You always
but not
prep.
Like
but
this.
Yeah.
Look at this stack of papers. There's a lot to this person. Okay. By the way, Angela Di Mayuga, if you are listening back to the show, check your DMs on Instagram. I sent you a little thing about Converse All-Stars. That'll make sense to people after they hear the interview. Okay. Without any further ado, here is my interview with Chef Angela Di Mayuga, recorded just yesterday at Narcissa Restaurant at the Standard Hotel in New York City. Here you go. I'd love to just start going all the way back to childhood.
Ooh, okay.
Well, we've never met before.
We've never met.
There's a couple of threads of your biography that are interesting to me.
Okay.
And I'm curious to know when they started and when they sort of intertwined.
Okay.
Okay? So, well, just if I throw it out that broadly, tell me about your childhood. Yeah.
Yeah. So right away, because we're here, because I'm a chef, I wanted to be a chef ever since I was a child. And I'm talking as early as like 5, 6. And I come from a big family. I'm first generation Filipino. So I grew up in a very busy household. Where
you were the second youngest of six?
Exactly.
Okay.
So that means I had a lot of older siblings to look up to. I had instant friends, basically, because of my family. There's six of us. There's a 3-year gap between what we call the big kids and the little kids.
Okay.
And the little kids, from my older siblings' perspective, were like crazier and funnier and... You know, we had things that we got to do, like we were allowed to play outside more because my mom being Filipino, and if you think about colorism within different ethnic backgrounds, she was worried about my older siblings getting tan. But with us, we had a lot more freedom, basically.
She had developed a tolerance to certain things.
Yeah, as a first
generation. With the starter kids.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Okay. So she had six kids. Often when I'm just talking with her, I'm like, I cannot believe you had...
Yeah.
Six kids, you're amazing.
And she was a professional.
Yes.
Yeah.
So she just retired. She was an executive admin to the VP at Intel. But prior, she worked for IBM, which is why we lived in the Bay Area because of her job at Intel.
Got it.
And then my dad is really interesting to me as an adult chef because he was a manager at McDonald's with McDonald's for maybe 17 years.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of our opportunities financially came from their tireless hard work, but also my dad's success as a really great manager at McDonald's.
Is this story I read true? Is he indirectly responsible for the phenomenon known as the extra value meal?
Yeah, I actually wrote that title because I kind of helped edit that piece, which I was really happy to, but I wish I was able to verbalize it more properly because,
so here you go.
Well, he invented the concept of set meals at fast food restaurants.
As so sort that's of a even promotional bigger. Thing.
For him, no. So McDonald's made it promotional because they were the ones to have the power to coin it, the extra value meal, and allow that you can, as a customer, get, I think you got like 10 cents off if you ordered a set to encourage them to order sets. But what my dad was actually interested is what he was interested in was specifically to allow people to order faster. So that's how he sort of sold it to his regional manager, where what he did was sneakily work with his Coca-Cola rep, who he had a really great relationship with. He got him to give images of a Coke, burger, fries, Coke, McChicken, fries. And he made a light board and he put it in his location. And the way that he was able to sell it actually just be allowed because that was against the rules for the place or for that property. He was calculating how much more sales they did during rush, like lunch rushes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I forget what the exact amount of time, but he was able to say, well, look at our sales. We've been able to save 13 seconds from each order. I should be allowed to do this. And then it eventually got to a VP, and they commended him for his work and then turned it into an extra value meal. But it's a very immigrant story. I, I, It was really fun for me to start thinking about this critically as a adult chef, where when I was starting to look at my family's work, like what my mom's done in her life, and you know, learning about my parents as an adult, just chatting with them, there are these instances where I realized that this is where I get certain characteristics from my parents. And I think as we get older, we think about that kind of stuff a lot. But I think really when I started becoming really professional chef and getting recognized for it, I was so much more appreciative of these stories that my dad could share with me, because, you know, technically I'm the only person in the restaurant industry. I mean, some of my siblings are interested in food and have worked in restaurants, but as a professional, I think that gave me and my dad a place to candidly talk about work and candidly talk about the food industry. Because he was someone, even though I wanted to be a chef as a child, he was somebody that when I was becoming an adult at like 17 and thinking about culinary school, he advised against it just for quality of life. And I was never interested in the glamour. I think at that time, Food Network was just becoming a thing where, you know, Emeril's our first celebrity chef ever. Yeah, I was watching all of this, but I never felt like a kinship towards that. That was never why I wanted to cook food. It was more for the craft element and the fact that it's a social activity. Because as a child, me cooking and watching cooking shows as a 5-6-year-old, that meant I was helping in my household. My chores that I was helping with that were fun for me was helping cook. I was doing lots of laundry, but I was also cooking a lot. And so my dad really advised against it just because it's unglamorous. I mean, I rarely saw my dad because he would work really wild hours, like late in the night.
Yeah.
But when I did get to see him, he'd really relish that time. So, you know, I have these fond memories of my dad as a McDonald's manager with his like Golden Arches shirt, sure, and tie, because the only people wearing ties at McDonald's were managers.
Okay.
And he was a general manager, and he would do things like go to the 7-Eleven, because if he got off his shift late, he could buy me like Pop Rocks and like treat me, right? So those are the like interactions I had. Or like as a child, I also, since I never got to see my dad, or not enough, I would go with him. I would accompany him doing the grocery shopping, and you know, for me, that meant I could like select a couple treats as like this like food type, like food interested child,
yeah,
but then help select, you know, what we might cook for the week. My mom did most of the cooking.
So as when you say you were interested in this from as young as 5 or 6,
yeah,
was it that you just liked cooking that much? Did you enjoy the end product so much? Did you just like food that much? Did you, I know it's a cliche, but they're often very true. Like, did you enjoy giving, you know, people, a lot of people who come to cooking young talk about, you know, the pleasure that other people take? You're smiling as I ask that question. Can you place it, or are you too young to remember?
No. I can place it. I have these very visceral memories of enjoying, like, touching food, giving people food, discovering recipes, and writing recipes. So some in particular that are really fond for me are, you know, like there was this cookbook that was really instrumental, I think, towards maybe why I view cooking as a really like creative work. I think we all do, but specifically for me, I had this cookbook, I think I was maybe 8, and we had the Scholastic book drive, or we had the opportunity to buy books.
Book fair, right? Yeah.
And I believe this book was a Scholastic book, and it was called Gross Goodies. And Gross Goodies, I also was born October, so I love Halloween and I love October. Since forever, I still do. But Gross Goodies is a Halloween cookbook, and I just thought it was funny. I also really love joke books. I was really into, I don't know, kind of like these like funny, like for me, I thought it was really funny.
Silliness?
So I like silliness, and being like part of the younger set, I was a lot more silly than my siblings. So Gross Goodies was something that was really funny to me, because they would have Halloween recipes like earwax swabs, but it's like marshmallows on a straw with dipped in peanut butter. But my favorite recipe was called Crusty Belly Buttons. And Crusty Belly Buttons was just a funny name for thumbprint shortbread cookies.
Right.
And those are just shortbread cookies that are round with the dot of jam in it.
Okay.
But I was really fascinated in the recipe because, one, the reason why I liked it is because we had the ingredients at our house: butter, flour, sugar, jam, because my mom would make us peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. So that was something that I could see in the cookbook, and I would say, that this was something that I could actually do because I didn't have to ask for the help of anyone. Mm-hmm. And then I had a captive audience because I had all my siblings and a lot of their friends were always over at our house. We had a really busy, fun house. We wouldn't really actually sit down for dinner together because my older siblings had work. It was more social. And so if he had friends over, I would make what was a signature like pastry of mine, which was crusty belly buttons, and I would get requested to make them. Mm-hmm. And then as I got a little bit more older, like I became a little bit more refined. I remember my aunt gave me this spiral bound cookbook that I feel like was put together with her and her like church friends. Mm-hmm. And there was a recipe that became a signature of mine that people would request of mine then, I think at like 10 years old, that was for a very classic dish, spinach and strawberry salad with goat cheese and caramelized walnuts, with a raspberry vinaigrette. So that was kind of a wild like flavor because back then raspberry vinaigrette was sort of new on the market and considered gourmet. And
it sounds like something out of the Silver Palette or something.
Yeah, it's a funny recipe. And like we always had raspberry vinaigrette so I could make this recipe. Yeah. But I was making recipes too, like as a even younger person, like 5, 6, I was doing things like we had a lot of fruit trees in our backyard in California, and we had a Granny Smith apple tree. And I remember the first recipe I ever wrote, really disgusting because I was a child and I liked candy and I didn't know any better. But the recipe is it's called baked apple. And you just take a cored Granny Smith apple, cut into cubes, and mix it with cinnamon. And my recipe stated that you mix it with 1 cup of sugar, wrap it in an aluminum foil ball, and put it in the toaster oven because I had access to that stuff. And I remember just family friends just being encouraging of me. It's like not a good recipe, but they would taste it and they're like, Angela, this is amazing. Aww. They would just be really encouraging. And they would say, can you write this down for me on an index card? And I know that they knew it was bad.
Yeah.
But they would.
You knew it was bad.
No, I didn't know until later on when I realized 1 cup of sugar with 1 apple is not okay.
Right.
So, yeah, I have these there's a lot more than that. I have these memories. And so I guess deducing that from the short stories I'm telling you, there was a professional aspect to it in a way, like writing down recipes or caring about recipes. And I think because I learned that from watching PBS cooking shows. And so I was constantly watching I would watch cartoons, but Saturday mornings, that was the only day they would play, because I wasn't in school, I could watch cooking shows Saturday morning super early. Mm-hmm. So I would like to watch Jacques Pepin and Julia Child. But they were also super personable and sweet.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that Jacques always had his daughter Claudine on the show. There's something really special about that first, I think, interaction with food TV, which was that for me.
But you've also, I've seen in interviews with you where you've talked about watching them and liking them, but also only being able to relate to them so far.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because of for reasons of ethnicity.
Yeah, I think that.
Did you perceive that as a kid, or was that something you didn't perceive that gap until you were older?
I think that, you know, where I've mentioned that, the reason why it's worth mentioning is just considering my own visibility or when I started to have a larger platform as a chef, I was really considerate about the amount of work I'm doing or the amount of public appearances I do because I didn't feel like disconnected. I didn't know any better. I mean, likewise, when I was starting to like my own genres of music at like 11, 12, there weren't really that many like Filipino or Asian artists out that was accessible to me, just in like on the radio or on MTV. And I always thought, you know, for me as an Asian American, there was this binary of like what I had access to. So there was like, say, white artists and black artists. And I grew up listening to a lot of black artists. And I think as an adult, I thought about that a lot more. And I think it was because it was the other. But then when like I was 12 years old, I got really into No Doubt and Gwen Stefani because I loved that she was from California. She was like this front, like lead, like she was a lead singer of an alternative band that I actually really liked. And it's really funny too because I didn't think about these kind of things then, but there's like some things that are slightly problematic about Gwen Stefani. I love her to death. Mm-hmm. But, you know, what she was doing was adopting like Chicano culture, like in Southern California, right, and Indian culture through fashion, wearing bindis on her face. But I still love her. It's just that's what I sort of gravitate towards. So when I talk about, you know, knowing that I loved Jacques Pepin and Julia Child, it wasn't that I thought of that then. It was just really thinking about my own career and trajectory and like where I put my time. And it became really meaningful to me to talk about my life and talk about my personal identity, because how different would I have turned out if there was a young female Asian chef or Filipino chef? I don't even know what that would have looked like, but I think that's important for just doing more and being more visible.
Question for you. I'm struck that you were using the word Filipino, mm-hmm, all through this conversation, mm-hmm, and then in the last 2 or 3 minutes, you used the term Asian.
Yes.
Now, Hoony Kim was, mm-hmm, on this show about a year ago, mm-hmm, and we had this conversation, and he kept using the word Asian. And I, mm-hmm, said, you know, if I were to use the word Asian in 2018, mm-hmm, that would seem hugely unsophisticated, mm-hmm, and unworldly.
Yeah, yeah.
But what he explained to me was that for him, in New York, he felt part of, you know, speaking more largely or more, mm-hmm, generally.
Sure, yeah.
He always felt better, mm-hmm, if there were more just generally Asians around. It, mm-hmm, made him feel a little more part of the society, yeah, of a community,
sure,
even though his background is Korean, right?
Yeah.
And you're nodding and smiling as I say this, but it struck me that you did the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Do you relate to that comment that he made to me?
I do. I think that, you know, especially with my career as like, you know, working at Mission Chinese, for example, I was exploring a lot of Asian flavors. When I first started working at Mission Chinese, I had never had Sichuan peppercorns ever. And so a lot of that, you know, when I got hired there, what I was really excited about was that creative challenge of like, okay, one, I've never thought about cooking Asian food professionally before. Maybe that's like sort of systemic. That wasn't something that, you know, I was averse to. I never thought of it. And I think it's because we always think about, you know, if you're like a young chef or you're interested in becoming a chef, you think about cooking in European kitchens because that's what we've been told to do.
Certainly what you were. Yeah. That goes back to the TV again, right?
Yeah.
Even the American was, mm-hmm, cooking French.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you know, that's a whole, there's so many different routes we can go with, yeah, that simple statement. But, yeah, then once I started cooking Asian food or considering it, I saw it as a creative juncture. I was really excited about, okay, one, I never thought of doing this ever. Two, this could be really interesting, and I'm interested in how I apply that myself to that. And I think as far as, you know, this feeling of belonging to a greater, like basically a race, you know, right away, the through line that I was thinking about, that I talk about a lot with other Asians is we kind of like always talk about rice and like how amazing rice is. And I don't know, for example, I did a charity dinner at Olmsted in support of the Trevor Project.
Mm-hmm.
And I made a rice dish. But when I introduced myself to the staff during lineup, it was important to me to say, one, what the inspirations behind the dish – well, what the inspirations behind the dish was, which was an Iranian tadig that a friend made me, and then also blended rice that you get at Korean restaurants when you get barbecue. I love that. But then I wanted to just sort of give them a brief on me that – I'm the creative director of food and culture at the Standard, but I formerly was the executive chef at Mission Chinese Food, mostly to just tell them I know how to make rice,
mm-hmm,
and it's going to be good.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be a wacky rice that is actually very – could be in a fine dining sphere, I think,
yeah,
and really good. And so for me, it was to give context. And I think maybe being a chef in New York City, it's important to give context of – like my experience cooking, I think I've become really comfortable cooking what I call Asian American food. And I think that's just important just as almost like just like a little bio. I need people to know that there's a way to cook rice that I was taught. Like I tried to pass off the task of cooking rice to one of the cooks, and no shade to the Olmsted cooks, but it's something you definitely have to finesse. And it's a look and feel thing. You're looking at steam. You're looking at how to cover the pot properly, when to add more rice, when to not touch it. You can't. It's something that's quite difficult. So I think that largely answers like why I adhere to that. I think it's also you know, we are divided by people are talked about via their race. Like just going into a cab in New York City, if I'm having conversation with the driver who's really friendly, one of the first things that he wants to know is what kind of, like, if he notices I'm Asian, he'll want to know what kind of Asian I am, or he'll ask me where I'm from, and I'm like, I'm from California, dude. Like, what do you want to talk about here? Do you want to know my ethnicity? Because I can just tell you that.
Yeah.
And then I could, what I normally say is, like, my parents are from the Philippines, because mm-hmm. It just really cuts out a lot of that. But it's a question that, you know, being a person of color, people wonder and ask, and mm-hmm. I'm happy to share it. I think it's just that finesse of how to get there, yeah, right? Yeah. So, but then talking from a professional sphere as a chef, yeah, the food that I, because of my global influences and my training, yeah. I do feel like I'm cooking from the perspective of an Asian American in New York City, but specifically Filipino American, because I've realized over time getting used to the way I season and why I look at protein a certain way is I think of, you know, how my mother cooked for me or how my grandmother cooked for me, seasoning meats a certain way, eating things with a lot of rice, using vinegars as acids and not just citrus. So I think about that kind of stuff a lot in regards to my professional work.
Mm-hmm. You spend a lot of time with people in the art world, the fashion world, mm-hmm. I hate the word creative, but for lack of a better term, yeah. people in the creative realm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sitting here with you. If you don't mind me saying, you're famously, your fashion sense is phenomenal. I was wishing I had a better wardrobe getting ready to come talk to you today. But I have good taste. I just, you know, I can't, I can only, you know, you got to know your limitations.
Okay.
But where did that come from in you? Like, where did your, you know, I know you like to throw parties. You as a kid, beyond the kitchen, were you mm-hmm. engaged in visual arts? Did you have sort of either literally in your family or sort of surrogate older mm-hmm. brothers or sisters or people who you hung out with
yeah.
who kind of took you under their wing and kind of showed you this kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Like, where does your confidence mm-hmm. and aptitude
mm-hmm.
for that kind of thing? Because it's one thing to do that somewhere
yeah.
else.
Yeah.
It's quite another thing to come to the world of New York or go down to Miami mm-hmm. or wherever mm-hmm. and put yourself in that mix and be able yeah. to not look foolish, right? But you do this. So
yeah,
where's it come from for you?
So if we want to scale back all the way to childhood, I don't know if there was any proper indications of that.
Yeah.
The same time that I was watching, I really liked PBS. I liked watching Bob Ross. I would like copy Bob Ross for fun. And I liked to draw a lot as a child.
Were you good?
I was pretty good at drawing, yeah. but I wasn't like a stellar like art class student. Mm-hmm. I think maybe a lot of that came from not knowing, because I went to Catholic school from kindergarten through 12th grade. And most of the schools that I went to did not have like pretty extensive art programs. However, when I actually sort of convinced my parents to let me go to this high school that my sisters did not attend. And that was a very concerted effort that I made very deliberately, where I was already starting to realize my own like confidence in decision making for myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, I don't know where that came from. I feel like I had a lot of courageousness in my family that they recognized and would tell me. All my siblings would say how courageous I am because I was fearless in doing things like on family vacations, jumping into like using a rope swing and jumping into a pool of water or like a lake, and none of them wanted to do it. I don't know where that came from. So that felt really intrinsic, this like courageousness or courage.
Can I ask, did you yeah. have a fear of those things that you pushed yourself past, or did you not even have that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Like
no,
the jumping into the yeah. water, was it just like, I'm going in there and that's it?
I was just like, I want to do this, so I'm being allowed to, like with a tour. I'm thinking about this trip to Hawaii. They offered and I had the opportunity to say that I want to do it, so I did it. And all my siblings were like, you don't even really know how to swim well. Like,
mm-hmm.
I'm like, I'll be fine.
Right.
So I had this courageousness that that's how they would refer to it as a child. Also, as a child, I have memories now that all these things are coming to me as you ask these questions. I was very social. I remember one of the houses that we lived in, I was allowed to play outside more. And I remember making friends with a neighbor. I don't even know where he lived, but he just started playing with me on our lawn. Mm-hmm. And I remember bringing him over. And my mom's like, you can't just like take this kid off the street that his parents need to know where he is. And I'm like, it's fine. We're just going to play. So I remember being very social that way, not mm-hmm. just with my siblings, but just with new people. And then as far as, you know, being interested in fashion or art, I definitely was a child that liked to dress myself. I remember having favorite clothing items, like my favorite shoes, which my dad and I called my star shoes. They were Converse All-Stars. And so I still have an affinity towards them. I like won't wear them as much because I can't take myself as seriously. But at 4 years old, I started loving these specific like Converse All-Stars, were eventually like being kind of a nerdy collector. I wanted these American made Converses because they break down a certain way, but I had these bright teal ones that I needed to wear, and I had this little luggage that I had that was a McDonald's little mini suitcase for kids' toys, and I had things in there. I had toys in there. I had these heart-shaped sunglasses that were like iconic for me as a child. So I was very aware of myself. I needed to find, like, if I was, say I had a sleepover with friends at 5 years old, I would want to wear my cool pajamas, which were like a matching sweatsuit. They weren't actually cool. It's just I wanted to wear a matching, say, teal sweatshirt mm-hmm. with matching sweatpants. I remember throwing fits because I like couldn't find my stuff because, you know, as a child, you're not actually responsible for your own stuff. But so I have these very specific memories of liking things and being allowed to act this way, like allowed to jump in water, like this pool of water. Everyone knew in my family that Angela's signature sunglasses were these heart-shaped sunglasses. Mm-hmm. Like we got to make sure they're in her little luggage when we go out. And then being someone, you know, like in my like early teens, starting to like alternative music and knowing that my siblings didn't really like alternative music. And then what I was going to get to is I went to a high school that my older siblings didn't go to. All of us, for the most part, went to the same school, all six of us, because that was important to my mom. And at the time, my three older sisters went to this school in San Jose called Presentation. And there were two private all-girls Catholic high schools. They were competing. One of them was in more of the suburbs where more wealthy families went, less diverse for sure. And then there was another school called Notre Dame in San Jose. And Notre Dame was known to be art-focused. It was a Catholic school, but it seemed more liberal. Like, I didn't know this language then, but it was more liberal. It was in downtown San Jose. A lot of the classes had integration with, say, you were taking an art class, you could take it. You could have a field trip at the Contemporary Art Museum in San Jose. Mm-hmm. So I was able to take I basically convinced my parents to let me go there. And I did, and there was a stigma around the girls that went to this school. I remember my older siblings saying, like, oh, my God, if you go to Notre Dame, you will turn out to be someone that's tattooed, pierced, and maybe you're going to be a lesbian. And, like, those things didn't happen immediately, but they did later, for sure. All those things.
That wasn't going on in your head yet.
No, I didn't know. Okay. I didn't know then. But what I was really excited about was just that it was super diverse. Yeah. And I could take ceramics classes. I could take photography classes. It was my first time taking leadership classes and enjoying it. Somehow the leadership class was related to religion, because you had to have a religion class every semester. Yeah. But I sort of was like weaseled my way into like, well, I'm going to take a leadership class because that seems more fun to me than the other religion classes. So that allowed me to start being interested in public speaking, reading from the gospel at church during certain I don't know why we'd have to go to this huge cathedral in downtown San Jose. It was like beautiful, but sometimes we'd have to do services there, and mm-hmm. that's what I like to do. And it was nice, like certain girls, like if they're interested in dancing, they would get to be part of like performance dancing that would happen at the services. I really feel like I started being more in tune with myself. I was also someone that you know, we had uniforms, but I definitely wore a uniform a certain way and had my own style and was able to make friends.
You pushed the limits.
I started dyeing my hair. I had my own fashion sense then. And I was also someone that seamlessly had friends from a lot of different types of circles. It's when I started getting interested in like punk and like pop, like emo and like music like that. And so a lot of my social activities lied with me going to concerts and hanging out with girls that maybe I wouldn't normally hang out with in my own high school. And it's a small school. It's 500 girls. There was only 100-ish girls in my class. Mm-hmm. So we all knew each other. We had our own cliques, but I was allowed to hang out in different cliques. And the way that I was able to convince my mom to go to this school was my sister, who was going to presentation at the time, who was less than a year older than me, we're like Irish twins. She started as a freshman at presentation. And then when I was interested in Notre Dame, was like, I'm going to join you there. So my mom could get a discount on our tuition by having two of her girls there. So I was able to make that happen. But also I was interested in that program because at the time they had a class that they called Home Ec. And that meant there were, I think, 12 stoves in one room and you could learn how to probably knit and cook, mm-hmm. things like that. And I was like, Mom, here's my opportunity to start cooking like in a class at a younger age. When I got admitted, they actually stopped the program because I think it was so 50-centric. Probably, you know, I think now they probably could have something like that if they called it like food and culture or history, something
or like
that.
Or like self-sufficiency.
Something. Yeah. But they basically...
But this was like Happy Homemaker.
Yeah, and yeah. That wasn't the vibe. Right. So they stopped. And I had a lot of really cool young teachers that wanted to be there because the girls were really excited and interested. But I, like, you know, moving into adulthood, not yet in New York, I kind of took the same approach when I was thinking about college, where... Again, I thought about culinary school, and when I checked out culinary school, I have this very vivid memory of me looking. I got the tour because you had to tour in order just to apply. You had to have
which
an interview.
One?
CCA in San Francisco.
California Culinary Academy. Okay.
Yeah. And so I went there, and it just didn't feel like it was for me. I immediately saw through what I thought was bullshit at the time, where I remember I was really impressed with what they offered, and I liked people seeing young adults cooking, older adults too, is a lot of career changers. I was interested in that. That seemed exciting to me. But the vision that I did not like was when the person that toured me opened up this door to a classroom that was in session, and it was like an auditorium. But I remember looking into, looking at all the students, and I couldn't imagine myself there. I was like, I saw a lot of career changers. I might be making this up because I just have this memory that was so bonded in my brain that made me not want to go to culinary school. But it looked like a bunch of career changers of people not my age. And I feel like everyone was wearing a chef coat and a toque. And I was like, what? I didn't understand. Yeah, I didn't understand. It didn't make any sense to me.
Was it predominantly men at that point or not?
I believe so. Yeah. And I wasn't actually looking for that kind of stuff then because maybe I didn't just because I went to an all-girls school. I don't really know. But when I looked into that room, I was like, these are not my people. I can't imagine myself here. Also, the fact knowing that I was supposed to be adult in this field of work at 19 seemed kind of wild to me. And I was really inspired by my older sister who moved away for college. So that's what I wanted to do. And the school that I first picked, I initially studied hotel and restaurant management, but I quickly changed to general humanities because I was excelling and really enjoying all of my humanities classes. I was taking philosophy for the first time and really feeling like I had a physical reaction to these classes where like it was opening up parts of my brain that had not been opened before. Taking gender studies classes for the first time, women writers classes, film classes, and I started getting 4.0s for the first time ever. So I decided... sort of against my parents, you know, me wanting to be a chef already, it didn't mean that I would have security or dollar signs like in front of me. But them knowing that I was interested in these classes, they just let me do my thing. They helped me through school, but I was taking a lot of student loans that it was really just for me. And as soon as I started college, I worked 3 jobs right away because I wanted financial independence. So they kind of like, they were just wanting me to get a degree, and that's what I wanted to do for them. And the way that I did it for me was taking humanities classes. So studying history classes. It was so fun. So
right.
I ended up getting my degree in general humanities. But I went to school in Southern California, specifically because I love this school. I like this idea of going to school called Cal Poly Pomona. And Cal Poly Pomona was 10 minutes away from a venue that I would always see when my favorite bands would be touring.
Which venue?
It was called the Glass House.
Okay.
And so it was 10 minutes from the campus. And so I basically take my classes, work my three jobs. And then for to meet new people, I would basically go to a concert most mm-hmm. nights during the week to meet people. So I was able to build this instant community.
I don't know if you considered it, but I know you said somewhere once that if you had not become a chef, that you probably would have ended up in academia.
Yeah.
So you really, I mean, yes, this was near the Glass House, and mm-hmm. but you really liked.
I really liked
you really school. Liked being in school.
I loved being in school. It was the first time one of my teachers that I had, he was teaching, I forget what type of English class he was teaching, but it was when I was 18, 19, and it was the first time I had a teacher really just stop me multiple times during my semester to tell me what a great student I am.
Oh, isn't that the best?
It was amazing. I'd never really had that before because I just didn't care so much when I was in high school. And he said, he was the first person to also just tell me, look, you're a big fish in this little pond and you probably should transfer. And I went to Berkeley and I would give you a really great recommendation. I think you would do really well there. I ended up not going to Berkeley, and I bring up that story not because I have a regret about Berkeley. It was just someone that told me that I could do more. And what I became interested in was travel. What I learned is that I wanted to travel more and I wanted to live in a city. And so the way that I did that I ended up studying European history in Glasgow because I was I want the opportunity to study abroad. And I did. And
how'd you fit in there?
It was weird. It was fun. I was dating someone Scottish at the time, okay. So it was a no-brainer. But what I loved about it was that I could fly Ryanair for $30 as a broke student to go to Rome for the weekend. I could go to Prague for a couple days. That's what I was interested in. Yeah. That's what I did. I went to Vienna. The fact that I was in all those places at such a young adult, I don't know how much I actually took away from that really because I was so broke, but it was important to me to just be moving around.
Yeah.
Yeah. And going, I had a lot of roommates from different countries, so they would show me around, and that's what I enjoyed doing. And then I finished my degree at San Francisco State. And I loved that. That was me wanting to move to a city and doing my thing, and that would be a little closer to my family. But as a kid, I always loved San Francisco. That's where I would also go to shows as a teenager. And so I loved my studies at San Francisco State. I had really amazing, very typical hippie San Francisco teacher. So I'd have a teacher with long, long gray hair and wore these caftans every day, and she would talk to me about her life in San Francisco in the 70s. I loved learning about these kind of things just from on a personal level with mm-hmm. these teachers. I had a teacher, one of my favorite teachers. He just looked like a really iconic, Folsom Street gay bear. That was his vibe. And he would teach me in my class because it was a class on media, art and media. And he would show us Karen Carpenter and the Carpenters and the Karen Carpenter biopic where they talk a lot about her eating disorder mm-hmm. and what it's like to be super famous as a singer for the Carpenters. That kind of stuff that really got me. Ended up becoming somewhat of a Japanophile. And my thesis that I ended up writing, just because I was selfishly just really into this band called Afro-Rampo, it was this band of two girls that played insane punk rock and roll music.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of reminds me of early Yoko Ono, but mm-hmm. even crazier, from younger girls.
That's a bold statement.
Yeah. And I loved that. I was obsessed with Japanese noise music and rock.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't have any better idea. So in my I decided that my thesis was going to be about femininity in Japanese culture because I just wanted to talk about Afro-Rampo. I'm how did they come to be?
Yeah.
And I just wanted to visit and go to Japan. That was me thinking that I can learn more about Japan and take steps towards it. Because yeah. Before I got to New York, I was at a crossroads too. I thought that I wanted to either go to culinary school again, like think about, I'm like, do I actually want to do that? I thought about moving to Chicago for culinary school. Mm-hmm. I also thought about just sort of prolonging my young adulthood by being an English teacher in Japan. And I was thinking very seriously about it. I had a lot of resources and contacts to make that happen. Or I would just try living in Brooklyn because I had a lot of friends that went to Pratt who loved me. And I started visiting Pratt back in like 2005, 2006 because I had a high school friend that ended up moving to Brooklyn.
I have to interrupt you because it yes. sounds at this point like there's so much life under the bridge for you.
Yeah.
I know you came to New York, unless I've read wrong, when you were 22.
Mm-hmm. 21.
Okay. 21.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So
yeah.
everything you're describing is pre-21.
Yep.
Did you start college early?
I started college at 17.
Okay. So not really.
Yeah. Like I'm a little younger, but not
but
really.
But not like yeah. little man Tate early.
No, no, no. Okay. No. Yeah. So okay. that's why I ended up in New York is because I had a friend and I loved all of her. That was my first exposure to artists.
Uh-huh.
These Pratt students, and they embraced me here and like really helped me like feel expressive and individual. And a lot of them are queer. Not all of them, but a lot of them were. But these are people that I still am friends with, and some of them are like really successful, like say industrial designers or right. artists. So that was my first exposure to like the like just being around artists, which I think then allowed me now like to be able to communicate and hang with people in the contemporary art world and mm-hmm. understand what I do.
So you come here, you end up working at Vinegar Hill House.
Not yet.
Okay.
My first job was I lived in Bed-Stuy right away.
Yeah.
Because all my friends went to Pratt and mm-hmm. I still live in Bed-Stuy.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a cafe that I went to just use their internet because we didn't have internet at our apartment then. And I was looking for jobs on my laptop in the cafe. And then I looked around and I was like, this place is actually really cute. There's so many people hanging out here that I don't see walking around this neighborhood. I asked one of the employees if I was like, maybe I should just get a job here just to start out. And they said they were looking, and then right away I met the owner, and that owner was a young female chef. And I was really inspired by her story because she lived half a block down the street, also in Bed-Stuy. This was her first business. She pooled the money to open the business by her own savings, but some of her family members were investors. And it was a dream of hers to open up a little cafe, and she was a private chef. So I right away learned about that as a potential hustle in New York.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, that's a thing that I can do when I'm not doing this, or I could do this eventually, where she stacked up a bunch of cash as a private chef and then opened up this place, which was so cute. They were making really great salads inspired by Greek food. Like this
what
being in
name?
Bed-Stuy, it was called Tiny Cup. It's okay. not there anymore. And it went through several hands afterwards, but through her, she was the first person, her and her brother, who was an investor. When I met him, I think I just had a strong handshake. I remember him telling me, Angela has a restaurant attitude. And I didn't know what that meant because we were at a cafe. But I started working as a cook there, making sandwiches and salads. But then she eventually let me have a lot of creative freedom.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
what
does that mean?
Creative freedom? That means
sorry. What does restaurant attitude mean?
Yeah, so I didn't know
I think I know, but no one's ever used that term to me before.
It was, I think I was, because I just took a lot of ownership for my work that I did there. Mm-hmm. I remember I paused in the kitchen to meet him, and I was showing him the stuff I had been working on. I didn't know what it meant then, but I think what he was saying is I had a lot of ownership for what I was doing there. Maybe felt comfortable in my own skin, felt like I maybe kind of like had a, like I owned the joint in a way.
Self-starter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I quickly moved up. I was just wanting to be a prep cook there. And then I quickly moved to start contributing to recipes. And then we started an in-house baking program because she wanted to. And then she just gave me all her recipes and I modified all of them. She let me, like, so I was going to, I would never have to go to the city at this time, but I looked up Sunrise Market and a Japanese grocer and like bought matcha, and I was making matcha cupcakes in 2007. And she let me do that. I would like go to thrift stores and look at Greek cookbooks and learn about like lemon and chicken rice soup, and then like mess around with that, add dill. Like I never grew up around like having dill, so I would play there. Mm-hmm. And then she let me also work front of the house. She was basically letting me be an assistant manager.
Yeah.
But really what was really beautiful about that opportunity there was that we closed the cafe around 7, and she would let me and someone who lived in the neighborhood who was also became an employee and was really dedicated, who was 10 years older than me. She let us cook there because she, that coworker, her name is Suzanne Barr, and she's actually become a really successful chef in Toronto.
Oh, that's why I know. Yeah.
Yeah. She was someone that I started to cater. Well, we were cooking together for an event. She said, "Oh, I have this gig. Do you want to help me with it?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure." So we but she let me be really involved, make menu items with her. We did it. Our first catering event was at the Alvin Ailey Theater. Mm-hmm. And it was a big deal for her because at once she wanted to be a dancer. And I remember I went home and I was like, oh my God, I made $600. This is insane. And from one night, and the food was really well received. We started out as our concept was we wanted to be an all organic catering company,
mm-hmm.
Which was expensive for us at the time. You know, looking at bags of sugar, you get a bag of sugar for $1, or I spend $5 on this organic sugar that doesn't actually really affect the taste. But that was something we wanted to do together.
Plus, you can only make like 5 apples.
Yeah.
Did this catering company, did it have a name?
Yeah, it was called Pepper and Sprout.
Pepper and Sprout.
Yeah. And I think I came up with the name and she was into it. I think, and I don't know if she's still using the name, but for a period, I remember she texted me or emailed me asking if she could continue to use the name.
Got it.
In Toronto. And I was like, of course you can. Yeah.
So can you, I feel like there's, you mentioned this cafe that kind of drew you a little
mm-hmm,
bit,
mm-hmm.
but there's a moment I feel like we haven't covered, which is the moment when you go, and maybe that was the moment, but mm-hmm. you had all these options, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you're this very curious person. You did really well in school. You like to travel. You've got all these other interests. But then there's the moment where you go, I'm going to be a cook.
Yeah.
Or I want to be a chef.
Yes, yes.
Was the moment discovering that little cafe?
Yeah.
Was it the cater? When did you decide you were all in, that all your chips were going on?
Yeah, I feel like I had so many critical moments in my life to choose that, and I kept going in that direction. I even asked the owner of the cafe, hey, even I was already in New York, but I said, do you think I should go to culinary school? And she said to me, I don't think you need to, just knowing your personality. I think that you may as well think about your work right now, as an apprentice, because this is how they did it hundreds of years ago. And think about this as an internship where you're actually getting paid really well. I remember I was getting tips. I was catering. And so as this young adult, I was pretty successful compared to my art school mm-hmm. student friends who had so much debt. And so it was, I kept questioning it and going, when I was all in, I feel like I was all in when I was at the cafe, because what I do is work daytime shifts, and then I had the keys to the joint, and I would cook for my catering events late into the evening, and then hang out.
And you didn't
with my
mind
friend.
Any of it.
I liked
like
it all.
You were happy to be in there. That's where you belonged.
Yeah, and like me going out to get additional ingredients for my weird projects, I was just doing that on my own time and enjoying that.
Yeah.
So I felt it then, but really, when I decided to change jobs, and I wanted to work at Vinegar Hill,
mm-hmm.
Which was recommended to through a friend. That's when I started to feel really chefy. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a tiny bride, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by Naoki Takahashi, a restaurant in the Chelsea neighborhood of Manhattan. When you dine at Naoki Takahashi, you'll feel like you've been transported to Japan. Sample a little bit of everything with kaiseki menus, or let Chef Naoki lead the way with his omakase menu. A la carte and vegetarian dishes are also available. Learn more at naokitakahashi.com. That's NAOKITAKAHASHI.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Dana Cowan, and I'm the host of Speaking Broadly here on HRN. Every week, I conduct intimate interviews with the brilliant, powerful women in the food world. We discuss their lives, their careers, and the ways in which they navigate the world at large. You can find Speaking Broadly wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you to the rest of our interview with Chef Angela Di Mayuga in just a moment. Caitlin, before we do, this is usually where I get promotional. Right. I'm not going to get promotional today. I want to just take 2 seconds. There was a review that popped up. Oh, it's very recent. I just happened to look at it the other day on iTunes. The person who wrote it has dubbed themselves Veritas Vos Liberatas. I accidentally did a Spanish accent, but that's Latin.
I was gonna say that.
I'm from Miami. I believe that name translates to "the truth will set you free."
Okay,
which is clever. I like that. This is by far the harshest review I've received on iTunes, and I want to thank Veritas Vos Liberatas. We should wake one of our kids who takes Latin. They could say this correctly.
I don't know about that.
Well, so this. This listener, I don't know if it's a man or a woman, has been listening to the show from the beginning, and I want to find the most relevant thing here. Firstly, it should be renamed Chefs Listen to Andrew. This person has worked and hosted many of the chefs who have appeared on the podcast, tunes in to listen to what they have to say. Sadly, however, as soon as they get going, you talk over them. Name drop to promote your book. Lead them off topic. Talk about yourself and your profession. Speak to you. I can't read anymore. But that's what that was the feedback. This is, I would say, constructive criticism. And with the exception of a certain restaurant reviewer turned book reviewer at the New York Times, I am always open
for criticism.
To criticism. Always. So, Veritas Los Liberatas, I want to thank you for your feedback. It is important to me to hear stuff like that. I can't say that, and this is a much longer review, I'm just not going to read the whole thing, but it occurred to me I should probably say for others who do feel that way that, you know, it is a goal of mine with this show to establish my own connection with the audience. I do feel like, you know, I've been around this profession for 20 years, and I do have sometimes I think worthwhile things to contribute to a conversation. But maybe I do that too much. I don't know. You don't know.
I don't know, but I told you when we talked about this a couple days ago that these kinds of reviews are always helpful because even if you don't take every bit of it, there's going to be some kernel in there that will make you better at what you do.
No, and it's good. And also, I have to say, if you are listening, Veritas Los Liberatas, I am slightly sensitive to this already. You would be amazed that I actually do cut out sometimes when I go off on a personal tangent and it gets too lengthy or it's a total detour. I have cut those out through, you know, the art of editing, but maybe not enough. I don't know. It is something I took to heart. And, you know, you were very gentle as you eased into this. I've been listening to this podcast from its inception and waiting a long time. And you say here to me, you say, Andrew, I'm not trolling. Please take this to heart. I took it to heart, and if you are out there and have feedback for me, you can certainly leave it in a review, or you can email me, andrew@toqueland.com, TOQUELAND.com. People have done that in the past. You can also DM me on Instagram. Our Instagram handle is @chefpodcast. I do check those all the time, and I would welcome your feedback. In fact, I need your feedback. Okay, enough about that. I am now going to return us to the rest of our interview with Chef Angela Di Mayuga. I hope you enjoy the rest of it.
Jean Adamson, the owner, came from, she went to culinary school. She worked with the McNally restaurants for the Keith McNally restaurants for years. That's how she ended up saving up money.
Wasn't she the first female sous chef at Balthazar? Or?
Yes.
Yeah.
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 And, you know, and she was very transparent with me when she opened up, or when she was interviewing me. She was like, I made this amount of money as a chef, and so I just want you to know what's possible for you in this career. And so I was always looking for guidance like that. And so when I was at Vinegar Hill is really where I feel like I became a chef, because I was running the line at, I think I was 21. I just turned 22 when I started working there. I was the most dedicated person there because I was the youngest. I wanted any opportunity I could. I was happy to weigh meat in the basement, but I quickly became a line cook because they got very, very busy. Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the defining moments that made me really confident was there were a lot of chefs from our immediate Brooklyn community that I was meeting that were started to work at Vinegar Hill, sort of cameoing for X amount of time because they were interested in live fire cooking, and not a lot of people were doing that then. So the reason why I was super excited about Vinegar Hill was not only working for this amazing, bossy, dynamic chef, Jeannie Adamson, who was happy to take me under her wing, but I got to work with live fire, and I never even thought that that was something that I would be interested in. I think as cooks, you're inherently pyros or like gearheads because you like toys and you like your tools and you like fire.
Can you speak to that for just 1 minute?
Yeah.
I don't think it's come up on this show yet. This is our 71st episode, but it is a conversation. You saw how I just lit up.
Yeah,
when
you got
that.
Really excited.
No, because there was a conversation I had. There's a chef named Tom Carlin who has two restaurants in New Jersey now, but he used to be a cook in the city. Mm-hmm. And he once made this comment to me that all chefs are pyros, right?
Yeah.
We both had known chefs who were really into like fireworks,
mm-hmm.
Who as kids would go in the woods and set stuff on fire.
Yes. I definitely did all those things. I still love fireworks. There was no woods in San Jose, but I would get the opportunity to play with fireworks on July 4th at my cousin's house. Not in my house because we weren't allowed to. But I also would start little fires in the bathroom. I would just light the toilet paper roll on fire just to watch it burn up, and then I would just splash water on it and I'd not be in trouble. Or I would make little bonfires in safe places, like on a little stepping stone my mom had. I would put it in the middle of the street so I don't get in trouble, build a little bonfire with sticks and light it on fire.
Do you have an idea what this is about?
I think it's just,
have you talked to
I don't
other cooks
know, maybe
about
it's
it?
Like, no, not enough. But I say it and everyone agrees.
Yeah.
I've said this a lot to
cooks.
It's
a real thing.
Yeah.
Not universally, not 100%, but there's a significant subset of you guys who are pyros.
Like light pyros.
Like,
light
right, pyros.
I'm not an
pyros,
actual
pyros.
Right, yeah,
low-level pyros.
Yeah, so
yeah.
For sure, and I've mentioned this, but it's all a joke. I've never dug in deeper than this.
Yeah.
But I also have mentioned recently the gearhead quality, because it's true. Like, we're all into our little knife roll and our toolbox. Like, I prefer to use a toolbox instead of a knife roll now, because it's cleaner and I could see all my stuff. I find myself and a bunch of cooks that I've worked with, we love these tools. They make their job easier, or we take joy from utilizing a new tool that maybe is designed really well. Like last night when I did my charity event at Olmsted, I was with the pastry team, like hanging out with the pastry team, and Natasha Pickowitz from Altro Paradiso was gagging at my – she loved my offset spatula because it's a single piece of steel, really light, narrow. Chefs need their, especially pastry chefs, needs their offset spatula. And I showed it to her and I was like, take a picture of it, see if you can find it. I got it as a trade for a cook from Milan. I traded him coon spoons, which you can get at any, like in JB Prince. It's mm-hmm. a designer spoon. And they don't have access to this in Italy. And we traded, and I'm a really good eBay hunter. So I thought that I'd be able to like find it on the internet anywhere or on eBay somewhere. Haven't been able to find it, but yes, we love our tools and we love fire.
Yeah, if anyone out there who is not in the business wants to see something that will help you understand a little bit about chefs, go to a knife store sometime with a chef.
Yeah.
And just watch them browse.
Yeah.
It's how much time could you spend in a knife store?
I could spend a few hours at a knife store. And I will pick up the same knife over and over again, trying to decide which one feels right.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'll look at all the small tools that I've never seen before at JB Prince here in Manhattan. This is like some light advertising for them, but it's amazing. It's fun. There are a lot of little things to learn about.
Well, it's an extension of you, right?
Yeah.
It's like a guitar to a musician. It's like a racket to a tennis player.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a deeply personal, idiosyncratic thing.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I mean, you could have 2 3-star Michelin chefs next to each other. They might have completely different taste in knives. Right?
Sure, sure.
I mean, it has nothing to do with quality of the food.
Yeah, it's an accessory.
It's a personal thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So Vinegar Hill, you also, though, you've spoken a lot about having this woman.
Mm-hmm.
Would you use the word mentor for her?
Yes, I do.
Mentor. Yeah. Jean. What exactly for you was the significance of that?
Of working with Jean?
Yeah. Specifically of her being a woman.
Well, people, once I started doing a lot more interviews recently, the last 4 years, mm-hmm. People really wanted to ask me questions about gender. They're like, what is it like to be a woman chef? What horrible things have happened to you because you're a woman in the kitchen? And at that point, it was my first leadership position at Mission.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have much to say about that because I naturally gravitated towards working for women previous. And, I always hated the question because I feel like it was very loaded. They wanted something that I couldn't really speak to as much. I mean, I definitely, there are things that's happened working for other chefs that are male that have been disgusting, but specifically working for Jean, for example, or Lisa Bayer, who was at the cafe, mm-hmm. or my coworker, or my partner, Suzanne, working with her, and she was 10 years older than me. I learned things from her. It was just this air of confidence that this can get done and it's not impossible. Really, that was my takeaway. And Jean was a very great, I would be curious to see her network. I really want to see a map of how many people she's influenced, where they've gone. Mm. People see her as a mother figure. She's really good at connecting. She's really good at training people that have never cooked before. All of that is so inspiring. And she also made me cook and made me a prep cook, made me a line cook. Let me run her line. So I was unofficially a sous chef there. I was expediting and working with what I was starting to get to is that I gained a lot of confidence because I worked with a lot of mostly male chefs that were all young entrepreneurs in Brooklyn. So Chris Perichini, who worked at Roberta's, mm-hmm. they would call me boss because I was running the line and do it like in a nice way where they knew I was in charge. I had things that I was learning from them, mm-hmm. but that I was doing an okay job and good job running that line. So I was working with Chris Perichini from Roberta's. His mother's name's Roberta. Andrew Fields, who started Rockaway Taco, who mm-hmm. eventually was in charge of developing all the F&B outlets on Rockaway.
Mm-hmm.
Brent Young, who started the Meat Hook. Anthony Falco, who is now being referred to as an international pizza consultant.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Eric Werner, who went out and opened up Heartwood in Tulum. And, mm-hmm. Those guys were just people that were working for me. They knew I was way younger, but they were super encouraging.
Yeah.
And so Jean let me run that kitchen. Like, that's pretty wild. Amongst those people that really respected her, they respected her, so they respected me. And they treated me well. And so Jean gave me that confidence. I always loved that. She's super confident, very direct, kind of curt in ways,
mm-hmm.
But also she's a very much of a people person and she mm-hmm. cares about her staff. And I cared about her a lot. I think it was fun working for her because she was working herself to the bone tirelessly. And I would happily say, like, you need to take tomorrow off and I'll take it a sixth day. It's fine. So that was...
Well, you had the youth, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, okay. We have to manage our time
now. Let's do it. Let's do
it. You are on a schedule.
Yes.
Give me... You obviously spent a bunch of years with Mission Chinese Food. I want to get to what you're doing here.
Yes.
And I also want to talk a little about politics and art and politics. What for you were the big... What are you most proud of what you did at Mission?
What I was most proud of is building a community there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the elements that really came from my personal desires of how to build a restaurant space as a living, breathing organism, somewhere that it was viable for me, considering my personal identity politics, being a queer woman, being first generation, all of that, I the systems that we made there, or like what I was proud of that community building, was really because I wanted it to be viable for me, mm-hmm. and it was beneficial to everyone as well. I loved making it, I wanted it to be an institution. That was something that I said a lot. And the reason why I was really obsessed with that is because I loved how restaurant spaces, especially like if we're thinking about as social spaces, can be places that people gather, have fun. You can bring your mom, or you can bring your friend, mm-hmm. or you can have like really good ideas and come up with good ideas with people. I love that. And I was really interested in making it a very energetically contextualized space that matched the type of cuisine we were making mm-hmm. there. So global influences, but I wanted it to be connected also to the visuals of the space. That's why I started working with artists collaboratively because I was hiring artists and curating our installation room, which was the rear wall then. I was really interested in getting people that were artists to design our business cards, and I was getting interested in design myself. So there was an awning there that I designed myself. It was really fun. It was just a big project that could mm-hmm. feel like the food could taste better if the vibe was there. And also, we had, you know, initially in 2012 when we had the smaller Mission Chinese on Orchard Street, it was so fun working with people that have never worked in restaurants before or hadn't had the experience of the position that they're in. Maybe I'd never been a server before, mm-hmm. maybe never been a cook before. It was my first time as an executive chef. So I was like, if this is my first time doing this, like it's allowed that we're all learning together yes. and dedicated. So that was, I think, you know, beyond making consistent good food and you know, learning how to become a creative chef within that sphere of building menus, you know, a 50 item menu, I loved building this ecosystem of people, and then people felt welcome to be there as well.
Mm-hmm. So you move on
mm-hmm.
and you come here.
Yep.
Now I want to get the exact title right. Both the company, Creative Director of Food and Culture.
Yes.
And the company is actually Standard International.
Yes.
Okay. That job, that position was created, if I'm not mistaken, for you.
Yes.
Okay.
It was. So
what is it exactly, and yeah. what was appealing to you about it?
The job exactly, I the way that I've been able to verbalize this to friends is there are three core elements to my job. Conceptualizing high-level ideas for renovations. So if we're renovating a food and beverage outlet, or we're going to be opening up a new location internationally, for example, creating ideas of what that restaurant concept could be. I've participated in naming certain places, like giving them names and explaining why. Mm-hmm. So it's concept. And then, you know, say, for example, there's a type of cuisine we want to make. We'll have to hire a chef that wants to do that and can do it their own way. Mm-hmm. So concepting is the major tenet of my work. And then partnership. So bringing in people that I think have a really great product.
This is the second umbrella mm-hmm. category?
Yeah. I bring in collaborators or people with certain products that I think feels like the standard, but also feels like what I'm trying to do to move the food and beverage forward mm-hmm. with the standard, and then programming. So I'm helping with organizing events that are food related or maybe not food related as well, cultural events or food culture events. So for a good example of that is why I work here. I participated in their first series called Chef Stands Up in 2017. And I cooked a dinner at their Miami Beach location. It was in support of the ACLU, where a bunch of artists and designers donated graphic designs for ACLU merch. And that was during Art Basel. It felt very Angela. It felt like this is the type of event that I want to be a part of. And mm-hmm. I love that. And so I ended up here because Amar Lalvani, our CEO, you know, now getting to know him so well, he really has a knack for finding people and putting them in his orbit, where he saw me as his creative person. He heard that my dinner went really, really well mm-hmm. and wanted to meet me. So I met him a few times and we really got along, and he was really interested in me continuing the weirdo work that I was doing. So that was, you know, conceptual dinner. I was doing conceptual dinners with scientists, performing performance artists, filmmakers, like in Japan at the time. I was doing a food directing, like a food design job for a fashion label for Paris Fashion Week. I did an artist residency where I taught 100 kids to think about food as sculptural and visual mm-hmm. rather than just for flavor. And he heard those three things that I was working on. And he said, well, why don't we create a position for you? Maybe you should be the creative director for culinary. And I pretended like I wasn't interested because I was freaking out about it. Because I feel like I manifested it in a way. I feel like I was just continuing to get to be myself, ideally. And because I always felt like these collaborations I was doing previous were to feel creatively liberated and not, you know, I really felt like it was important for me not to work with just chefs all the time. And I think I was more inspired by, yes, getting the opportunity. Like, I'm so fortunate and I love working with chefs, but I also have so many other interests and I wanted to bring that into my sphere. So it felt possible to do that with this brand. And in a way, I felt like I had already been doing some creative directing at Mission sort of
sure.
accidentally. And
But you said the opportunity to have it be your official job
yeah.
freaked you out.
Oh, it was because I was so excited.
Oh, okay.
I was pretending like I wasn't as excited because I really needed to think about it.
Okay.
And because I didn't, you know, we would have to build that together. And I knew there would have to be a lot of boundary building and knowing that it's a brand that's been around for a long time. It was hard to see myself right away in it. But because of that super positive experience cooking in Miami at our Miami property, it felt possible. So the reason why I was also freaking out in a positive way is because when I left Mission, I really wanted to do something that I never thought of before and it would be challenging and that no one would expect and I would learn a lot from. And I definitely saw it as such as I thought about it more and more.
I mean, could there be a better job for you in the world?
I don't know.
Not having ever met you before, when I heard about the job, about a year ago or more?
Yeah.
I thought, man, that is an amazing... For anybody, that's just the coolest job, right?
Yeah.
But now having sat with you for an hour, this is like... I mean, it was created for you, but it also seems like this culmination of your... I mean, you're young, but of your life so far.
Yeah, I think so.
Isn't it?
It is. I really do think that. And I mean, especially being with the company now
are
for...
Are you the happiest person you know?
I'm pretty happy, yeah. And I feel like I've really... Especially like... It's been 10 months now.
Yeah.
And I just feel like more comfortable because I'm learning about the systems and how things happen and still feeling confident. But the things that I've been working on are finally coming to fruition really soon.
Mm-hmm.
And that feels really gratifying. I feel like I have things to offer and I have a place to put it. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't feel limited to this job. It feels like I'm constantly being inspired by the opportunities that come up that can mutually benefit me and the standard and what the future of like the standards food and beverage is going to be.
Yeah. So can we talk about politics for a second?
Sure.
Because this is something that comes into your world. I was struck by something I read. I know you knew Anthony Bourdain.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a interview with you where you alluded to a conversation where he had said that his show was a political show disguised as a travel show.
Yes.
And you said something to the effect of that there's an artistic component to food and that art should be political, right?
Yes.
And so
it's inherently political, yeah.
Right. So if you I forget what the term in math class is, if you connect all those things, then food is inherently political as well, right?
Absolutely.
You come to it through the prism of art. Although maybe not exclusively.
Yes.
But can you just speak to that for a minute? Because I feel like, if I'm really frank, I feel like there's a lot of very facile politics around food right now. I think there's a lot of people jumping on bandwagons they don't understand. I think there's a lot of neat, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of, especially, I'm sorry, friends of mine, especially amongst a lot of food writers.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of... just knee jerk. This is what we're angry about now.
Yes, yes.
But sometimes it's applied wrong or thoughtlessly. Or but you know, following your career, you were someone who you live these issues, right? You're very involved in these things. You've thought about these things a lot. Yeah. So I'm really interested to hear from you. Mm-hmm. Is this question making sense?
Yes, I'm following.
Why it's political?
Yes.
How would you express that?
Well, I feel like, well, for one, for the last few years when I started thinking about my immediate peers within this food community of who I was inspired by, it was a lot of people, say I'm talking specifically about chefs. There are a lot of chefs that really thought about their work as intersectional. And there's a lot there where when I think about intersectionality in regards to personal politics or just politics in general, there's an air where you're thinking about like who are we cooking for and why are we cooking? And I realized over the last few years that my peers or friends or people that are in the food industry that's making the most interesting work are doing it because, say, for example, they feel like they're sort of on the margins within the food world. Or like, say, for example, there's a turmeric company called Diaspora Co. By this woman named Sana, and young woman in California who is Indian American and is sourcing directly from these turmeric farms in India, and making sure that she's paying them 12 times what these workers are normally paid. Like all of this stuff really matters to me because we're participating in this industry. We're cooking food. We're buying food from people. We're representing, say we're using an ingredient, we're representing maybe where it came from. And the people that I, including myself, I realized over time that things in my work that I felt were most meaningful were really personal. And also, if we're talking specifically about politics, intersectional. So we're thinking about all the people that are involved. Or, you know, even when I'm thinking about my chef that I hired here, Chef Max, I love that he's from San Francisco. I love that he has two moms. I love that I worked with him at Mission Chinese in 2012 and that he studied economics in Columbia. Like, well-rounded, I think about all these things at once. And so when I think about my own cooking or, you know, cooks that are friends of mine, they're thinking about their whole story and they're respecting that. And I think that there's then an authenticity that we can have with our own work and why we're putting it out there. So, you know, in regards to food spaces, I often think about who is the audience or why are we making this food? Like, why are we making these bar snacks? What's the purpose? And it might not be a political act of like making nacho, like Max making nachos because he grew up in San Francisco and loves nachos. But there's like this quality of authenticity that they have to why they're making the food that they are. And then it becomes really inspired. There's so many ways that I think I can describe it, but I think those examples are, there's just like a personal connection to it. You know, it's one thing to go to another country and love maybe cuisine. So for example, I just came back from Mexico City. I had a barbacoa experience there. That was really amazing. But if I make barbacoa here in New York, there has to be a reason why I'm presenting it. To me, there has to be a story. There probably will have to be a twist. Maybe I'll make it in preparation of like Filipino dishes that I had. I think like all of those things basically allow you to be really inspired. And then I think then it's worth being out there. There's so much food option. There's so much food around us in New York. And it doesn't need to be super heady and conceptual. It's just I think about who's running these businesses, why they're running these businesses.
This is a decision-making template.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
At all levels. Sourcing, staffing.
Yeah.
Creatively. Yeah? And how you talk to your guests.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You are the first guest I've had on the show who self-identifies as queer.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm honored.
What within the industry, again, I've seen interviews with you where you talk about bro culture in the industry.
Yeah.
For you, like how has this come up in ways that might not be obvious or apparent to
others? Specifically
being a queer
chef?
Chef.
Yeah.
Has it been an impediment? Does it come up? Has there been Has there been, have you experienced prejudice, cruelty?
I mean,
you're in New York, so I'd like to think if so, it was minimal, but kitchens are kitchens.
Kitchens are kitchens. And also, I think about this a lot, where I'm technically a millennial. Millennials are 18 to, I think, 36 or 38. Mm-hmm. So I'm technically an older millennial. but, you know, that there's been a lot that's changed within the restaurant sphere of even in my time cooking, where the types of chefs that I work with or types of cooks that I work with, there's a lot of, you know, from a generation before us, there was a lot of kitchen culture that we all know exists that is less, you know, it's just an environment that I didn't want to be a part of more and more. And I was realizing that. Mm-hmm. So there were certain things that I was doing with full intention and verbalizing it. I had a lot of fun in my first executive position role at Mission, having banter with my cooks about what it's like to be a woman in a kitchen, you know, during lulls. I enjoyed it. I had a stage.
With male cooks?
With everyone.
Everyone.
Yeah. Or, so for example, say a cook went downstairs, or no, not a cook. Say a guest went downstairs to thank us. Often this would happen. This is something Gene taught me, that they're going to look at the white male chef in the kitchen and thank them. And that happened numerous times. I saw this happen to Gene as well.
For the record, I started nodding the minute Angela started to tell that story because I knew where it was going to end. I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've seen it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think now this is changing. There's, you know, we talked about this knee-jerk reaction with journalists or writers, right? I think people are making a concerted effort to give more visibility to these other stories. And, you know, back then, I was happy to talk to my chefs about that. I was happy to directly tell the chef that got the compliment, hey, by the way, this is a thing that happens. And so we all recognized that when it would happen, we would all laugh about it and be like, oh, that happened again. But it's actually pretty grave and like sad. But it was something that I was happy to have conversations with them about. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, there's Jean coming up again where she made me really cognizant to this. And she would just, I remember casually like elbowed me on the line to tell me about that. You know, when I talk about bro culture, what I'm talking about is the same male chefs that are giving each other the same opportunities.
Right. You're not talking about a personality type.
I am talking about a personality type.
Oh, you
as
are?
Well. Yeah, a little bit of that too. So personality type, that must mean, you know, people that are obscenely, like, I think like unnecessarily vulgar, specifically against women
you would
or
throw
gays.
That under the bro.
I would probably put that under there. Okay. Not necessarily.
I get that. I mean, yeah. To me,
chef bro culture is what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I hear you. I mean, to me, there are people who at first sight can fit that.
Sure. Yeah.
Right. But could actually be super evolved.
Yeah.
Generous, great people.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're talking about sort of a tribalism.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Both of behavior and of opportunity.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yes, if we're just talking about, we're not talking about looks, we're talking about how they act.
It.
Yeah. And yeah. how they act, what their behavior is. Yeah.
Are you
in
optimistic
kitchens.
About kitchen culture?
Yes, I am. I'm pretty idealistic. I mean, when I got this position, I also instantly right away thought about, wow, this is really perfect for me. But I also thought about all the babies out there, like young chefs, maybe they're like me, maybe they're not, or maybe they're creative or not. But I thought about how with this job, it kind of single-handedly diversified what a chef could do
mm-hmm.
and how they could think about their work.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in a way, that's me being optimistic and idealistic that like, yes, I got this job. It's a fun job. I'm enjoying myself. It's challenging. It's great. But I also just thought about, okay, this kind of changes the conversation for some people that Angela got plucked out of this ether of the weird stuff she was doing and given an executive corporate job with a 20-year-old company that I'm enjoying myself in. And I think it allows a lot of people to just think about their work and intentionality about what they talk about, who they work for and why.
Mm-hmm. Do you have, we're almost out of time, I'm just so struck, right?
Because
there are elements of your personality that superficially, right,
mm-hmm.
are I don't know what I want to call it. I don't want to offend you. I just met you.
Go ahead. Go
but,
ahead.
You know, they verge on the diva. You know, like
ooh,
you. Well, the way.
Well, no one's ever said that to you before. Well, I'm actually honored.
The way. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think she likes that.
That's funny. Cool.
But do you know what I mean? The way. Look, the way you dress, I've seen them. I don't know, getting ready to talk to you, how many articles I looked at, and each one, you know, you were fabulously attired, right? Growing up wanting to go to a different school, you know,
yeah,
like pushing
cool.
the school uniform. Yeah. You have these ass elements of someone who wants and enjoys a lot of attention, superficially. But sitting here talking to you, even mm-hmm. when like I complimented you before on what you were wearing, there was what seemed to me to be this incredibly sincere modesty and appreciation.
Yeah.
The way you said hello when we shook hands today was you can tell a lot. You know, we made eye contact.
Oh my God.
What?
No, it's great.
Am I making sense?
No, you are. But I'm just like blushing. I'm blushing.
Are there two sides of your personality?
Oh, wow. You really touched upon a few things. I'm going to talk about astrology for just 1 second.
You do have a conference call, but I want to hear the answer
to this. I'm just going
to
say this.
Please.
I feel like you're very astute, and I feel really seen. So I don't know if you know astrology, but you basically touched on two elements that's part of my chart. I'm a Libra sun, and so that's me being very diplomatic and, you know, social. Maybe into the way, like loving to dress myself and loving to look at what other people wear. And then I have a Gemini rising, which people think is like two personalities, is what people say. But that's also, I think, where my collaborativeness comes from.
Mm.
Because they like project-oriented relationships, they like making work, and they like having fun doing it. And then I have a Leo moon, which is the attention. And your moon sign usually is like what you are on the inside, and I don't formally present that way as someone that likes attention. So I feel really seen.
Well,
it's good. It's a
I'm
good
glad.
Thing. Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah.
Are you blushing?
I'm blushing.
You're blushing
I'm
a little
blushing.
Bit. I'm
I've
sorry. I didn't mean to make you blush.
Blushing is a good thing.
This is what I do.
Yeah. You're good at your job.
Okay. I could talk to you all day.
Yeah.
You have to go. Thanks for making the time.
Yeah.
Great meeting
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Great to meet you too.
And, you know, knock him dead with this gig. I know you're already a year in, but obviously you got a lot ahead of you.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's our show for this week. Matt, our engineer, thank you. Caitlin, thank you. Good to have you back.
It's nice to be back.
Yeah. It's nice to have your voice on the air again. everyone came up to me after the live show and said, Caitlin has such a great radio voice.
Oh, my God.
They did?
Okay.
They did. You should have a show.
No. I'm too busy.
On a much more serious note, Top Chef Season 15, Chef Testant, and fan favorite, Chef Fatima Fati Ali, lost her battle with cancer at the end of last week. I had the privilege of spending an hour with her in October when her cancer had returned. We didn't know each other before that. It was an hour I think about all the time. I want to send my condolences to her friends and family. She was amazingly, given all she'd accomplished, just 29 years old. It still breaks my heart. And if you follow this industry on social media at all, you know that a lot of people were touched by this person. She was really something else. I'm going to leave you with a little snippet of my conversation with Fatima from last year. Rest in peace. But if you were talking to, you know, a younger person, or a younger cook, probably more specifically, that's mostly who listens to this, what would you say to people, you know, with the kind of perspective you have now?
Don't wait. Just don't wait.
For
anything to happen. Make things happen. You have to make things happen for yourself. Mm-hmm. And don't think you have the luxury of time also. You know, don't think, oh, I'm not going to apply for that job now. Maybe in a couple of months, or maybe like next year, I'll take that trip.
Yeah.
It's like, do it now. Don't wait.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you.
For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without the support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.